All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the forget about it? All right, let's focus. Let's focus. Huddle up. Huddle up. It's a difficult day for some people. Okay, I'm not talking to everybody right now. Look, some of you may be thrilled to be having Thanksgiving with family. This might be a high point. It might be an opportunity for you and your kids to see their grandparents, their aunts and uncles, and their cousins. You know, and that might even be the case, and it might be a terrifying and taxing, emotionally taxing experience. But look, I'm not going to begrudge anybody a wonderful day with their family today. But I would like to speak to the people that are entering this situation with not the best outlook or disposition or with good expectations. Maybe I'd like to reach out to them right now, because for some people, you know who you are. This is going to be a fucking nightmare. Today is going to be a nightmare. All right, look, let's give thanks. We'll give thanks. But man, we're just going to have to get through this shit. Am I right? Now, I'm not necessarily talking about me. You know, I've made some peace with the situation. I'm okay. I'm getting better. It's only taken me about, you know, 20 years to be okay. But you never know, man. You never know entering this situation. Let me do a little business here first. Then I'll get, but hang out. First, I want to say that today on the show, Rhett Miller, the wonderful alt-country rocker. Is that what we call him? The Old 97s is his band. He's also done some solo work. Nice guy. Phenomenal artist. He's going to hang out and play a song or two. All right. Let's get back to the task at hand, team. I'm talking to the emotionally volatile. I'm talking to the emotionally sensitive. I'm talking to the emotionally traumatized, to the scarred, to the people with resentments against mommy and daddy, or mom and pop, or mother and father, or whoever. Might be your grandparents. God forbid. They're the troublemakers. But this is a big day, man. We got to suit up emotionally. Am I right? Now, here's my pep talk. I'm improvising this. So look, I don't know where you are right now. Maybe you're already there. Maybe you're in it. Maybe you've taken a walk to listen to WTF to get out of the fucking house for a few minutes. Maybe the turkey's in the oven. Maybe shit is already cooking. Maybe you've already had a fight with your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your cousin, whoever, A, B, C, D, E, or F, whatever, pick it. Maybe you're the one who just lost their shit and is now running out of the house, taking a breather in the cold air, taking in where you grew up, maybe taking in where, you know, something very familiar to you. Maybe you're in the car. You're going to drive around a little bit. Hey, look, there's where you used to buy liquor when you were in high school. Oh, I wonder if that guy's still there. Oh, hey, I wonder if my friend's still alive. Oh, I wonder if that guy couldn't still be working at that place, could he? Maybe I'll go by there. Oh, shit, it's Thanksgiving. Nothing's open. I'm just going to drive around until I feel better, and then I'll go back home, and everybody will be like, hey, you feel better? And you'll be like, a little bit. Yeah, I'm sorry, I lost my shit. All right, let's get back. Get out of the fantasy. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of it. How are we going to have a good day today? All right, well, first, I think you got to open your heart and realize that you're a grown person, all right, if you are a grown person. Most people who listen to my show are grown people, all right? Whatever they're going to do, whatever buttons they're going to push, they're old buttons, and there's no reason that they should work anymore. So I guess what I'm suggesting, this is bold, disconnect the buttons before you go in. Realize where they are, and then, you know, maybe push them yourself a couple of times to make sure they're not registering, and just shut that, maybe close, you know, just, I would go on manual. I need no buttons. Just trust your instincts. Trust your heart on this, all right? Just, you know, turn off the whole panel and walk in and realize first, all right, maybe you're pissed off about something that happened a long time ago, and it's just ongoing, and it's never going to be let go of. And maybe it's just about the cycles of emotional chaos that happen when you go home. We all know that it's very easy to get around your parents and act like a fucking child. And it's going to happen a little bit. Just pick good moments for it. Maybe make it be positive. Whew, take a breath. If you're cooking, don't hurt yourself. you know, focus, stay focused, don't panic. If you need people out of the kitchen, get them the fuck out of the kitchen. If mom is intruding on your, you know, maybe your pie, say, look, I'm making a pie. You know, you can do your work over there, but just stay out of my fucking pie, mom. Whatever the case is. If you have family that enjoys sitting around watching sports and it's not your thing, let them do it. Fuck it. Go in the other room. Talk to the ladies. I'm sorry. I don't know what happens. All I'm trying to do is tell you to have a nice time and be grateful that whoever is still around is still around, even if they drive you fucking crazy. The one thing you're going to notice when you get back there is that everybody's getting older. You're getting older. Kids are growing up. Parents are getting older. Maybe grandma's still around. Whatever. It's just that there's not a lot of time, folks. There's just not a lot of time. With good families or bad families or troubled families, there's just not a lot of time. And God forbid your resentment is so deep that you just want them all to die. God forbid you're in that place and you're still going home for Thanksgiving. But for anybody else, remember, it's a finite amount of time. It's not a lot of time. If you can get some clarity, if you can get some resolve, if you can let some shit go this Thanksgiving, do it. Do it. If you can make it right and get some acceptance of yourself and your family, this is a great opportunity. If you're with a bunch of people that are avoiding their families, well, just have a nice time then. You made your choice. I hope it's the right choice. I hope you don't long for that shitty dish that so-and-so makes. And for those of you that this doesn't resonate with, well, good for you. Have a great Thanksgiving. We can get through it, though. You know, the people I'm talking to. We're going to be all right. All right? Because I'm sort of telling this stuff to myself, too, because I wasn't going to go. There were some issues and like, you know, I have to cook and, you know, I was like, do I have to cook for everybody? There were some issues and I haven't been in a couple of years, but, you know, I realized like, you know, everyone's getting old, man. You know, we don't see each other enough unless you're down the street. That's your choice. I know they help with the kids. All right. So we're going to talk to Rhett Miller in a minute. And I just want you to take a breath, man. Take a breath. I know she's annoying. He's annoying. They're annoying. I know it. I know you're about it. You're on your last nerve. But you know what? You get to go home. And theoretically, everybody loves each other. All right. So happy Thanksgiving. And let's talk to Rhett Miller now. So you're with the old 97s?
Yeah.
You're touring this new record.
Yep, we've been on a
bus. Which I have. Right here. Cool.
Yeah.
Most Messed Up. What are you, 12 albums in?
This is the 10th 97s album, and then I've made 5 solo records, including the one I made in high school.
How do you look, the one you made in high school?
Yeah, which is embarrassing. And it's only,
is it embarrassing?
It's only out in, we made 1,000 copies of the CD.
Yeah.
And I signed and numbered every one. And I had a British accent. What can I say?
Did you really?
A 7th generation Texan kid in Dallas, but you know all the people I listened to were Echo and the Bunnymen and David Bowie. And
so you affected
Camera.
That?
Not intentionally.
Right.
I just the music I liked. That's how they sang.
I mean, that's what you do.
So
it's like when you play. I mean, when you play guitar, you're gonna feel somebody else.
Yeah.
You're gonna pop strings I like to land somewhere between Angus and. And Peter Green.
Nice.
If I can, with nice. My limited understanding. So what was that first record? It was just you?
Just, well, my bass player in the old 97s produced it. He was like a few years old. He was 7 years older than me. And we had girlfriends that were friends. We got introduced. And he gave me my first gig opening for his band, Peyote Cowboys.
Peyote Cowboys.
Such a great psychedelic band.
In
man.
Dallas?
Yeah.
And this is, what's his name? What's
your Murray Hammond.
You've been with him that long?
Yeah. Since I was 15 years old.
And he's a couple years older, I guess?
He's turning 50 in 2 days.
So he's like, what?
I'm 43, so he's 7 years older
than
me. Oh,
wow. So he kind of took you under his wing in a way.
He taught me how to do gigs, taught me how to smoke pot, taught me everything.
You need that guy.
Yeah. It's important.
Well, let's go back. You're growing up in what, suburban Dallas?
Big time suburban Dallas. I was kind of on the outskirts of the rich section because my grandfather had a shit ton of money. For like generations.
So you're one of those sort of like Texas aristocratic families?
Well, but it's kind of funny because my grandfather managed to squander the entire fortune before I was even born.
Was it oil or land?
Textile.
Textiles.
The Millers were a textile family. And
what did they make? Like fabric?
Yeah. In fact, I think most of the money came from kind of like profiteering during the wars. They would sell, you know, uniforms to the government.
So they had government contracts.
Yeah. Yeah. And made a lot of money. Big Dallas money. Had the biggest house across from the Highland Park Country Club. But then in 1954, my grandfather, who was always ahead of his time, decided he would buy a professional football team. So the New York Yankees football team.
Which there was a Yankees football team?
Yeah. And they moved to Dallas and became the Dallas Texans.
Yeah.
Lasted less than one season. And it was
a disaster.
That was it.
That's where he lost all his money on a fucking football team?
Who would think you'd lose money in freaking Dallas, Texas?
How can he? Well, I mean, he made a big jump. It was a vanity project.
Yeah. And in a way, I think he shot himself in the foot. He did some stuff that I'm sure he would undo if he could.
Did you know him?
I did. I knew him a little. He died when I was like 17.
And what'd your old man do?
He's still a lawyer.
Yeah?
He used to be the kind of lawyer that did a lot
you
of
You say
like,
lawyer like a Texan. I like it.
Yeah.
It's just a twinge. You don't have a lot of it, but I hear it.
Oh, and when I get off tour with the guys, it's a little more. Ken, our guitar player, Ken.
Yeah.
Like they'll say, what's his name? Ken?
Ken.
Is it Kim?
Ken?
Ken.
Ken. Ken. So, okay. So your dad's a lawyer?
Dad's a lawyer, and now he does all this like good guy stuff, helping out people who are debt collectors or harassing them and stuff like that. People getting evicted.
So he's come full circle.
Yeah.
He made some bread, and he's giving back now.
No, he never made any bread.
Oh, he didn't. He was always a good guy lawyer.
Yeah, he used to tell us that every third generation makes the money. That's what he would tell us.
And so is that on you now then?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, it's too much pressure. My brother's doing pretty well though.
Older brother.
Younger. I'm the oldest. He's a year and a half younger. He's a CFO of a Fortune 500.
He's a financial
company.
Guy?
Kind of.
He's the guy that says, why are you spending so much money?
Yeah. He's like, we
might want to pull it back a little bit.
We should acquire this competitor.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you don't know what kind of company it is?
It's a marketing company that mostly deals with like churches and Greek organizations, like fraternity kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah?
He's a super sweet guy and super smart. You know, I guess our lifestyles on paper seem very different, but we're not all that different.
Well, you look pretty good genetically. You seem to be holding up pretty well for a fucking rock guy. I mean, you know what I mean? You're maintaining your healthy, good looks. Your hair looks
good. Thanks.
Do you diet?
No, I did put a couple of highlights in this year. Thanks for noticing.
but you're not shying away from the gray?
Well, I haven't had to deal with it yet. I imagine I might go vanity style and
you're gonna be that guy. Come on, man. You country guys, you're supposed to age hard.
Well, my bass player is doing it for me.
He's doing it for everybody. Really? Isn't that weird, man?
It is a little
to
weird.
Think how long you've been doing this? But I didn't realize you started so fucking young. That's why. You're younger than most of the guys in the band then.
Oh, yeah. I'm by far the... Well, no. Phillips, our drummer's only 3 years older than me. But.
All right. So what happened? So you're growing up in Texas. You got money. That's a whole other... Well, your family does a little bit. That's a whole other thing in Texas. Texas money is... There's something that it could be obnoxious. It can tend to be obnoxious.
Dude, are you kidding me? growing up in Highland Park, and the weird thing was that we had sort of the trappings. There was the things that fell through when all the money disappeared. There was a good house.
Yeah.
That got turned into a slightly less good house.
Right.
And, you know, kind of trading down. But staying in the Highland Park school system, which my brother and sister went to.
Yeah.
And it's not evil, but I mean, you know, where does Dick Cheney live? You know, where does George Bush, you know, they
Junior?
All live in Highland
does
Park.
Does Junior live there?
Yeah, yeah. That's where his museum is in Highland Park. His museum is a block away from the house that I ended up growing up in.
I think I can't even imagine what's in that museum. George Bush, George W., not
W,
senior.
W.
W's museum. His presidential museum. What's he got in there? Some baseball paraphernalia and...
Picture books. I don't know.
I wonder what's in there. I'd have to go in there just out of curiosity.
Maybe I will.
So is he somebody you'd see around?
No, I mean, I don't...
He moved there later, I think, anyways.
Yeah, and I haven't lived there for 10 years. Uh-huh. Or no, God, I haven't lived there for... A long time. It's 97. I moved to LA.
So what were you doing as a kid? When did you start playing the guitar?
I started at 12 and it hurt my fingers too bad, so I stopped.
Do you ever get joint pain?
Yeah, and on this tour I hyperextended my right knee, and so I've got a sprained
With stage antics?
Yeah, dude. And I'm such an idiot. Like 43 years old, and I climb up. If it's a good gig, and I feel bad now for people that saw gigs where I didn't do this, but if it's a good gig, at the end of the night, we start our final song, Time Bomb. It's always the final song of the encore. Yeah. And I'll climb up on the drum riser, and then climb up on top of my amp on the drum riser. And then, you know, when the first big hit of the song happens, I'll jump as high as I can off the amp. And sometimes, because some of the risers are pretty high, my amp's always the same level, but, you know, I'm catching like 12 feet of air and then landing it. And I fucked it up.
Huh?
In Chicago, I landed it with my knees locked. And woke up in the middle of the night that night and just felt like, what's wrong with me?
I just felt pain from you saying locked. And I just got hit with the pain.
Yeah.
But okay, so you're 12 years old and you play, and then you, like, in junior high, when did you cut that first record with
Murray?
Yeah.
I was 16. It came out when I was 17.
And what was it, a country song?
No, that was when I had the British accent.
No, I know, but I thought maybe it'd be...
Well, it was exactly the same kind of songs I write now. It was really just strummy, folky, you know, definitely one foot in the pop world, one foot in like the... I grew up loving like folk music, so...
Like who?
Like the Kingston Trio, like real square.
Where'd you get that shit?
My parents, my mom.
Your mom had Kingston Trio albums?
She was a singer. She was always in choirs. Her dream was to be a backup singer for... I don't know, like Barry Manilow or somebody like that.
Really? Your mom's dream was to be a backup singer?
Yeah, yeah.
She get like in that documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom. I think it's a low pressure gig where you could probably really enjoy yourself. It's probably not even that low pressure. I mean, you got to have the goods.
Well, Sheryl Crow did it for years before she went out on her own. She was like a Michael Jackson backup singer.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I had no idea. Do you know Sheryl Crow?
She's got a great voice. I've gotten to do stuff with her. She's super nice.
Yeah, you've gotten to do a lot of stuff with a lot of different people. Because it's weird with musicians. Like, even if I listen to a couple records that I really like the musician, it doesn't... all of a sudden, if I got to talk to you, then I'm like, all right, let's see what they've been up to. I'm like, oh, I've missed everything. They've had an entire career. There's 900 records, and I know that one.
Well, I used to see you at Largo all the time when we were both at the old Largo.
Yeah.
We both hang out.
I know you were part of the... you've always been sort of... There's a couple of you guys that seem to be around the... There's like you, Ted Leo, Amy Mann, Nico Case. Yeah. There's some people that seem to kind of run in the same circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like the most inner circle with the John Bryans or the...
Oh, yeah, and John is a Largo guy.
Watkinses.
But I don't think I really know John. Like, I kind of... Like, because I lived in New York and I'd come into Largo occasionally.
Yeah.
I never locked into the... You know, like, Paul F. Tompkins and Galifianakis and those guys were there all the time and they knew John. Like, I just know John is just like, oh, he's that genius guy that Mary Lynn used to go out with. I know him as a mythic personality. He's a myth to me.
He's kind of that way even with people that are friends with him. I mean, he exists in some other sphere, you know? And now, as far as I know, he's totally on the backward schedule, John Bryan is.
What does that mean?
Wakes up at 9 o'clock at night, eats breakfast, goes into the studio.
Well, he's like a savant.
Yeah.
Like a pop music savant.
He's on a spectrum.
Yeah, of some kind.
Yeah.
that's what always my feeling of it was. And then when he produced... he produced one of the Fiona records, right?
Yeah, he worked on one and then produced...
And then he produced
a couple.
Right, and then the Kanye West record. That was like, when I heard he did that, I was like, what the fuck?
Dude, I went into the studio when they were working on that, him and Tom Biller, his engineer at the time, who's super great, and they were like, come on down, Kanye's not here, it's super fun. So I went in and it was real weird.
Kanye's not here, it's fun.
Yeah. It was real weird, it was all quiet and dark, and they're like being super serious. And I hung out for a while just watching him work. And finally, I was like, dude, what, you asked me to come down. You said it was fun. What's going on? Yeah. They're like, well, actually, Kanye is here now. But he's in the vocal booth taking a nap with a lady. He had been standing on the street. Chick walks by. You want to come in and hear my dope beats or whatever?
Yeah.
Winds up in the vocal booth 5 feet away from us.
Fucking.
Going to town.
Yeah.
I was like, that's why I got into this business.
Yeah, this rock and roll right there, or hip hop, or what, just, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what, because you always had that, a real pop sensibility, obviously, from when you were in high school. Like, there seems to be, I know there's obviously crossover, you know, you do all the stuff with the old 97s, it's your band, but there's a tone there, you know, that you honor, that's traditional, almost.
I've pushed them. There were a couple of records where I really wanted us to try out. God, I remember in 99, I was listening to a bunch of Belle and Sebastian, which is, I don't know if you know them, they're Scottish, or kind of fae. a guy called Fela, which I think people, when they say that, they're usually making, you know, talking shit. Well, are they
right?
But they would have strings and they'd have all that kind of stuff. Real lush, you know. But I liked it because it was fucking pretty, but really clever words and cool melodies. Whatever, I was into it. So I pushed the band on fight songs to try and be just a little less, because we were coming from a world, we'd made a record for Bloodshot Records, which is,
I know those guys.
Boy, they were pushing the term honky skronk at the time. And I was like, I don't want to be involved in anything that could be described as honky skronk. It's what alt country eventually became the tag that people used.
But the weird thing about what alt country really was is that I don't think any of you necessarily realize what you were really up against.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, even like Steve Earle and those guys that, you know, I think early on, Steve Earle, in my mind, what he was doing as alt country earlier than probably what you guys were doing has become mainstream country. But yet he was still outside. He was off the grid. And if you're off the fucking grid in that Nashville, you know, political situation, where do you land? I mean, how do you build an audience?
Well, for a while, Nashville country was kind of like what Steve Earle was doing back on
Guitar Town.
Yeah. But I don't know if my finger's definitely not on the pulse of this, but I've recently been hip to what's happening in Nashville country now is it's becoming like hip hop, like real white bread kind of hip hop, where these, oh my God, and the product placement,
right?
And there's like just a checklist of things. You got to talk about your truck, your boots, your gun. You got to name what brand of beer you drink, what brand of truck you drive. But the songs will be like, driving down the road. I mean, they're like straight up hip hop songs,
right?
And with Def Leppard guitars on them.
Interesting,
crazy. If you go, they call it bro country. But if you go now and check it out, what's happening? It's nightmarish. It's like post apocalyptically bad.
But like when you guys were starting out, I never understood what the fuck the problem was with mainstream. I guess it wasn't mainstream country, but it always seemed to be that there was some real kind of tension between the established order in Nashville and what was being called alt country, which was actually more country than Nashville was producing at that time.
Yeah,
did you feel that?
Yeah, and it's funny now, you look back at what Nashville was producing at the time, and it seems really kind of sweet and tame in comparison, but it was just real poppy. We've had a hard time in Nashville as a town to play in, when like nobody ever thought we'd get airplay on country radio. You know, that was never even a thing.
But that's all politics, isn't it? Because the songs are fucking there.
Sure. They're too much there is the thing. I remember when Elektra was trying to push us to rock radio and or, you know, even AAA, which is, you know, kind of the sweeter, milder format.
Right.
But, you know, and they would I'd have big wigs at Elektra come to me and say, why does your stuff have to be so sophisticated?
But what does that mean? Minor chords?
Exactly. A bridge? I don't know.
It's like you guys go off the chart with that sweet sounding sad chord.
Yeah.
You know, can't you just keep it in the 1-4-5 region?
Yeah.
Where we understand the turnaround?
No, I think they were talking about the lyrics too. I think I was a little too tricky for them. But
oh, too clever?
What am I going to do, man?
Well, no, you got to be a poet. You can't just all be, you know, flat out. I mean, there's a lot of great turns of phrases in country music and old country, but I mean, you know, if you get a little elaborate or you get a little sophisticated, it's like, they're just driving their trucks. They don't want to think.
Yeah, no, the country world's never one I even thought for a second I could crack. I did wish
But yet you played country music, really.
I know. That's true. But
and
then,
you're from Dallas.
But like the alt country thing is something I've thought about a lot because it's been my world for a long time. If the Beatles, their very first kind of records, the skiffle stuff, if that came out in our world today, they'd be alt country. If Tom Petty's first stuff came out, they'd be alt country.
Oh, hell yeah. Mystery Man?
Yeah.
Great. And there were some great country songs in the first couple Petty records, really.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. And the funny thing is now that's sort of everywhere I go, like all the bands I see playing are bands that are basically doing kind of just alt country, some version of roots Americana rock.
Right.
And it's awesome. Like for when we were doing it in 93 when we started, it was the grunge era, you know. And I remember a big part of why we started was Murray and I were doing these rock bands. It was so fucking fail, you know. And
you were in them?
Yeah. I was fronting Rats Exploding and Buzz and these terrible, terrible bands.
What were you playing?
I was the lead singer, guitar.
What was he into?
Playing electric guitar. And Murray was in and out of them because he was frustrated by it. And my problem was,
what was the music like?
It was a lot like what I do now, but instead of swingy, it was real straight, you know?
Yeah.
It, you know, there, there was some mid-tempo swing stuff, but it was a lot of like sludgy mid-tempo rockers, you
right.
know, with kind of clever words,
right.
or whatever. It was
yeah.
what I do.
But were they, because you're pretty good at a pop hook. Were you doing
yeah.
that? A lot of that?
I thought there were some great pop hooks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I didn't have enough experience to.
You like a pop hook.
Dude, I love it. 2.5 minute pop song with a couple of really juicy hooks. That's yeah. the best thing to me.
And that's really the model that has fueled, you know, radio hits forever.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you've been looked over?
That's funny that you asked that. I did a thing with Paul F. Tompkins the other. We did a Wits taping. You know,
yeah,
the
NPR yeah. Oh, sure,
show,
that's John. Fun. Yeah,
such a great show. And right before we walked on stage, I guess he had just come from a radio visit, which he and I.
Is that what you call him? A visit?
A radio visit, exactly. You know, promo obligation.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think a lot about how comics, like you do a lot of road work.
Sure.
And Paul does too. Your lives are a lot like my life.
But
I'm not always on tour with the 97s. Really, most of the way I make my money is to go out with one guitar, you know, with two guitars by myself, play a gig. So it's a lot like what you
right.
do. And so I'm sure that you get sent, you know, you got to go to this station
sure.
and plug the gig. And,
sure.
And you do it. It's fine. It's what it is. But so Paul had just done one of those and we're standing side stage in St. Paul and he looks over to me and he goes, dude, this radio guy just asked me the question that like every other radio interviewer asks me. Do they ask you this? He goes, a lot of the people that you came up with are really successful now.
Yeah.
How does that make you feel? And I get that all the time. I'm like, well, you know what? Like,
I don't know if I would. I don't think I framed it that way.
No, you didn't. You didn't. Yours was.
But no, because I get that a lot. You know,
do you feel overlooked?
Well, yeah, overlooked is sort of different because it's one of those weird things because no one can deny the power of the music and the talent. And there's plenty of songs that you've done on your own and with the old 97s that are like, how come that's not huge?
Yeah.
And it's overlooked in the sense that sometimes it's just fucking timing. Yeah. Who the fuck knows who makes that decision or why it happens? If someone had the equation of how to solve that, you know, we'd all be making $1 million.
I know. Our tour manager, Mike Dahlke, has this theory.
He just said it all with that.
I know. If you appear on TV, you should get $1 million, right? If your face is on
that
TV.
That doesn't even matter anymore. Fuck knows? It's impossible to know what's going to make the most number of people go like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
What's your tour manager's theory?
Oh, Mike Dahlke, that's it. If you appear on TV, you should get $1 million, right? That's how it's supposed
to
work, right?
It's sadly,
that's what people think.
They do think that. And for years, I was on TV a lot, and that was the only money I was making. You know, you go on Letterman as a band. What are you guys? Maybe you get enough to buy yourself dinner.
No, it's a pretty good payday. Those because
for bands because of the
AFTRA, like they have to pay you a certain amount.
Well, right, but as a band, they pay everybody a certain amount. Everybody gets the AFTRA minimum.
It's weird, like the lead singer gets the most, the drummer gets the least. It's such a hilarious hierarchy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, of how it works.
And what about the music? What about music licensing? Like if they replay, how does that work?
It's that thing where every time it airs, ASCAP goes out and beats somebody up and gets money
from them.
Yeah,
well, that's good. Thank God for ASCAP.
ASCAP's great.
It's fucking great, man. I mean, they have one now for a satellite play for comics called Sound Exchange. Are you guys on that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and that's where I get it. And it's like, wow, free money. How do I make more money when I'm sleeping?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what Tom Waits had, the great line that I think about all the time. He was speaking at South by Southwest and he's kind of in between songs on his piano and he goes, you know, I got into this business so I could write a song and then say, now fly away and go make daddy some money.
All right, so wait, let's go back to 94 93. So you and Murray are kicking it around in and out of rock bands.
Oh, dude, and we were living so wheels off and so shitty. We were eating ramen noodles. Like, I had a full scholarship to Sarah Lawrence College to be a creative writer.
You went to a fancy high school, right?
Well, that's what it was. So I was going to this, skipping back to my grade school years, I was in Highland Park with all the rich kids.
Yeah.
I got beat up because we didn't have a maid. I got beat up by rich kids. And basically I had a reading is fun pin on when I was a fourth grader and a fifth grader came up to me and said, the principal told me to punch any kid that was wearing that pin and punch me in the face. And I was like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm literally getting beat up for being like not a dummy.
For being creative. For being a guy that wants to write and do things cool.
So I researched.
You're an arty kid.
Yeah. So I researched other schools. I said, fuck this. I'm going to go to a private school. And I found Bard College has Simon's Rock of Bard's, this smart kid school up by where I live now in the Hudson Valley. And then in Dallas, there's a school called St. Mark's. And it was an all-boys private school. And it was It's a fucking great school. It's amazing, you know. So I went and I just set it up myself. I asked my parents. I said, I'm going to do this, and if I can get into one of these schools, can we figure out how to pay for it? And I went to St. Mark's, and I remember I was a fourth grader when they interviewed me. I was summer after my fourth grade year, and I was applying for sixth grade. And they said, so what books have you read lately? And I said, you know what book I just read that I really loved was Catcher in the Rye. And they're like, why are you reading that as a fourth grader? And I'm like, I don't know, because it was supposed to be good.
Yeah.
And but I talked about his relationship.
So you were
a precocious
fourth grader?
Of course, yeah. And so I got into St. Mark's, and you know, even that, there's still football players everywhere you go, you know, like the kids.
Yeah,
that,
even if they're not playing football. It's a character type.
And I learned pretty quick that I shouldn't necessarily be playing football. It was a moment where they line up in those drills where you're all like, you carry the ball, you tackle him. And so the big mean kid that I knew hated my guts, like, counted the people and lined up across from me. And then when he tackled me, he'd whisper through the ear hole in my helmet, quit the team, faggot.
Oh, no.
And after like the fifth time, I was like, you know what? For an idiot, he's giving me pretty good advice.
I'm out.
But
I should go back and thank him.
Exactly.
Wherever he works.
But I had fun at that school. You know, it was...
That happened at the fancy school?
Yeah, that was the fancy school.
There was a line drawn.
Yeah, so I hung out with the weirdos there. And then I started doing music. You know, at 15, I was doing gigs at... You know,
but what were you doing? Primarily
week.
Writing? Were you involved... Were you writing poetry? Were you writing...
You know, it's funny you ask. I was. I was the editor. We started a literary magazine called The Rag. We thought that was so cool.
Yeah, right on, man.
Yeah, The Rag. And I wrote a lot of poetry, and then I realized that writing poetry is not cool. Like, it's...
I did it. I mean, I think that was the when I was in probably ninth or 10th grade, you know, I had an English teacher and we were assigned poems and I wrote poems. Everyone wrote poems and, you know, we were going to read them out loud in class and mine were just like gut-wrenching.
Angsty.
And they never looked at me the same way. They were sort of overly sensitive and talking about how everything's like
meaningless.
Fake and, that and just sexual frustration and that kind of... And I never got looked at the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got that power. Poetry can alienate as well as enlighten.
But if you put some chords under it and sing it a melody, and it's the same exact thing. I mean, poems,
absolutely.
I love it. So I get to secretly be a poet now and nobody makes fun of me. To my face.
But so you did The Rag and
did did all that stuff.
And
did gigs.
But when did you start writing songs?
13. So played guitar at 12, quit, went back to it because I was like, I gotta fucking write songs. This is driving me crazy.
Yeah.
And I was pretty tortured. You know, my parents were going through there's a line in a Robin Hitchcock song, and it rained like a slow divorce.
Yeah.
It's this such, and my parents' divorce took 10 years. And it was
10 years because your dad's a lawyer.
Well, no. It's just because they didn't want to break up and they should have. And eventually they did. But, you know,
you were 13.
I was seven when it started and 17 when it ended.
Oh my God.
And I'm not blaming them for I was just a fucked up kid, you know. The world made no sense to me. Like, why is it that the assholes get to win? Why is it that, you know, I get beat up for reading books, you know? Like, they'll call me opera singer and then stick my face into a locker. And I'm like, opera singers are fucking cool.
Yeah.
You know, none of it seemed fair.
So you felt alienated, but you didn't, like, you weren't driving around breaking things. You went inward, or did you drive around and break things?
I went inward. At 14, I had a suicide attempt that was pretty gnarly that really should have worked, you know?
You did?
Yes, I did. And I've made a point not to talk about it much.
So at 14, you know, at that point, you're right in The Rag. You're playing guitar.
It was the pointlessness of it. Like, well, what do you do? So you grow up, you try and get a job to get money, to buy a bunch of shit, fill your house with the shit, look at it, dust it, die. Like, it just seems so fucking
pointless.
Oh, so
the emptiness.
Yeah.
You went Nick Drake.
Existential.
Yeah, you just went like, you played it out.
I saw where it was going. I saw the end game.
But you didn't see that, you know, that even though you were making these observations and that you enjoyed things that most other people didn't enjoy, there was no hope there because there was no winning.
Well, at 14, there wasn't. But then very, very quickly thereafter that, I discovered sex with girls.
Well, how'd you try?
Oh, the suicide.
Yeah.
I thought you meant the sex.
I know how that goes. You get the hang of it eventually.
Yeah, it took a while.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I basically decided I was going to drink anything with a skull and crossbones on it. So I went under the sink in the guest bathroom, and I found all these lamp oil fluids,
yeah,
which actually was the thing that ended up saving my life, because they're oil-based, and even though they're poison, they coated the lining of my stomach. And then when I went up to my mom's medicine cabinet and downed every pill in every bottle.
Oh, my God. Which, this is like, it, you know, like took you, you had to go room to room.
Yeah.
That was a, it's a moving suicide attempt.
Yeah.
Like, you just go like, well, what else is there that I can ingest?
It was crazy. And then a lot of Valium, which slowed my system down so the toxins couldn't pump through. The whole, for trying really hard to take all the wrong shit, I took kind of all the right shit to not die.
Did you go down? Did someone find you?
Or? I did. When I realized, I went and sat down in the living room, and I was like, okay, now what? How long is this going to take?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, this is really happening. My legs are numb. And something about my legs being numb made me want to run. So I ran out the back door and to the railroad tracks a block away. And I ran down the railroad tracks to the Knox Henderson little shopping center that was near our house. And when I got across the street from on the border, there's a 7-Eleven parking lot. And I just went face down in the 7-Eleven parking lot. And there was this really beautiful girl named Barry who went to the Arts Magnet High School. And Barry,
you knew her?
No, I didn't know her. I ended up being friends with her because she saved my life. But she saw me go down and she's like, this is not right. So she went over and rolled me over and found a number in my wallet that was my girlfriend's phone number.
You had a girlfriend?
Yeah, I did.
So there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah, it was complicated.
All right, so Barry, what'd she do?
She called the girlfriend whose dad was a doctor, and they came and picked me up and took me to the emergency room.
Not an ambulance.
Well, you could have just called an ambulance. But I think she thought maybe I was just fucked up, and she didn't want me to get in more trouble.
Right.
So I went, and they didn't pump my stomach because it would have killed me, so they induced vomiting. So I guess I was unconscious, but I vomited for hours and then woke up the next morning and that weird thing of surprised to be alive, like, oh shit.
didn't work. Wow. But then you became friends with Barry.
Yeah, I became friends. I wanted to go out on dates with Barry, but she was like 17.
She like must have came like some sort of unwanted angel.
She was so hot too.
Really? What was going on with the girlfriend that, you know, drove you over the edge?
I don't know.
How much of it had to do with that?
Well, I know over the years that she has been sensitive to, because when it happened, it was, you know, all of our friends knew and everybody knew, and, you know, and she and I might have had a fight that day, but that was just one piece of, you know, my mom and I had a fight that day, you know,
right?
The universe and I had a fight that day. It sucked, but you know what I figured out was, and this is actually one of the other reasons I knew coming in here today that I'd probably wind up saying this was, I've been working with the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And
now,
just recently. And I think it's something nobody fucking talks about because it's so dirty and embarrassing. And it's so vilified. You know, it's like, oh, the most selfish thing you could do. Well, the people that are doing it aren't thinking about it or trying it because they think, fuck you. They think, fuck me. I'm fucked. My world is fucked. The world would be better without me.
Yeah.
And that's a horrible thing to think. And it's something that you can outlive. And I'm not going to go PSA style on you, but it is something. I outlived it. And within a year, I was writing songs and I had my first gig within a year of that and played in front of people. And the next thing you knew, I had all sorts of reasons to live, you know?
Right. Well, I think also that if it's not necessarily depression driven, mm-hmm. but it's driven by the hopelessness that comes from, you know, problems at home or like trauma of some kind, that where you're just, you know, the discomfort is so intense or the hopelessness is so intense, you don't see any point. It's definitely a different thing. You can grow out of that.
Yeah.
But people that battle with that listlessness of depression, wow, I have a hard time even picturing it, you know, what that decision, because when you're in it, the brain's tricky. You honestly think of a whole list of reasons why it makes sense. It makes perfect sense because you can't see it ever being any different in that moment.
That's
the worst.
That's a tough thing.
Well, yeah, but that's also like, it's one of those things where, you know, as a sober guy, you know, that when you want to drink, you know, people are like, well, it's going to go away. It's going to pass. you know, just wait it out or go to sleep. Tomorrow's probably going to be better. But if you're locked into something like, fuck that, every day's the same, you have no ability to see forward or behind you to make any rational decision.
Yeah.
But were you, when you came out of that, I mean, you know, being that type of poet, with the one suicide attempt under your belt, that's some cred in a way.
Yeah, I used it. I cashed that card in.
Did you?
I got dates. I got gigs. I got bands.
You were emo before emo. You were a troubled boy.
Well, I have thought about that, actually. I remember when emo started happening. I'm like, they're just doing what I do, but they have a little less twang, you know? There's a lot of those 3-4 waltzy kind of songs. A lot of like, oh shit, the world is full of shit kind of.
Well, I think that what you're talking about really in relation to the hierarchy of what is mainstream high school at that time, it's just that those kind of, the kind of kids you were, it's going to be a rough road no matter what.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just happen to be in a period now where, you know, people can sort of find their own way. And that turns out to be a fairly profound and popular niche of that type of troubled teenager. But I think it's always been there. But it was just that the paradigm was so set. You know, you're either a jock or you're a pussy.
Oh, especially in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'm sure Albuquerque, New Mexico was,
well, we had a lot of like, there's a lot of Latino influence. Oh, we had a base, you know, the mix there, you know, there was a pretty big black community, and I went to a public school, so yeah, it was there, but it was definitely more diverse.
Yeah,
because I think that Texas can get pretty white and pretty weird.
Yeah.
There's definitely class lines and ethnic lines.
Oh, it's a real segregated town.
Yeah,
it's tough. I'm so glad that I live now in, and nothing against Dallas. Dallas has gotten a lot better. I've still got family there and tons of friends. But, you know, I live in New York. You know, there's black kids and Mexican kids on my kids' baseball team. They're all friends. Nobody even talks about it. And it's funny, you know, my 8-year-old daughter, you'll say, like, who's your favorite person? And she'll go, well, it's either Rosa Parks or, you know, and it's just because Rosa Parks is a fucking badass. That's why.
Right. I think it's sort of fascinating that the tide has turned a little bit for kids who are sensitive and creative, because really there was the jocks, and then there was the pussies, and then there was the math nerds, or people that no one knew how to talk to.
Yeah.
They were just playing Dungeons and Dragons, and, you know,
I was that too.
You were that too?
Yeah.
Really?
I was not a math nerd, but I did play Dungeons and Dragons. It, like, I would be, one night I was opening for Lords of the New Church at Club Clearview. You know, Steve Bader, kick-ass punk rock band, or whatever, goth, proto-goth.
How old were you this time?
16.
Really?
And then the next night I would be, you know, at my friend John Greenman's house in the garage playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, that makes sense, I guess. But 16, so you were playing in a band that was good enough?
No, I was solo. I was a teen folky. And in Dallas, I got kind of embraced. I would open for Red Cross when they came through, Lords of the New Church. I opened for Chris Isaak right before Wicked Game
at 16?
With my little Ovation guitar, my 12-string Ovation.
Round back.
Shittiest guitar in the world.
And you were just singing your songs?
Just singing my little Seashell Girl Keeps Fire Inside. Yeah.
Oh, my God. So it was kind of like Nick Drakey in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And boy, it's funny. I think now, I think back on it, and some of the lyrics on that record I made in high school, like, I would never write lyrics like this anymore, not because they're bad, but because they're so shocking. Like, there's one song, Ryan Miller from Guster has become a friend of mine, but apparently when he was young, he had Mythologies, the record I made in high school, and played some of the songs. The first ever Guster gig, apparently they played the song for Truman Capote, and there's a line in there, well, the beer was on the floor, his wife was on her knees, he was pissing on Christ, and she was praying for peace. I would never write pissing on Christ in a song anymore. And I don't know how in high school it seemed like a great idea and people loved that song. But
now I feel bad because like I don't want to do a disservice to you because I know that you have very passionate and loyal fans. So they all know Mythologies. I mean, Mythologies.
No, they don't. It's the, if there's a holy grail of my catalog, it's not on Spotify. It's not on iTunes. 1,000 copies exist. When they come up on eBay, they sell for like $350. I mean, I've tried to keep it out because, for two reasons, it's a little embarrassing because of all the British accent.
Yeah.
And I kind of think it's fun. It's so pre, you know, 21st century to have something that's not available. It's cool. Like, how many things are not available anymore?
So that's, okay, so that's 89. So you're 16.
I guess it came out when I was 18.
Okay.
Yeah.
But still.
It was fun, man. Those days, because my parents were going through so much that, and it was kind of a different era. Like, kids, you know, when we were kids, you'd ride away from the house on your bike in the morning and come back at night. Nobody fucking asked where you went, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
they had their own things going on.
Yeah. So as a teenager, my life was a lot like that. Like, I got a gig tonight. I'm going to crash at so-and-so's house. And there's this artist commune warehouse where people had just art studios and music studios.
Yeah, yeah. Those are cool.
Yeah. And so I used to just sleep on the floor of this, you know, gallery. And
so really that generates, see, I live the same life in a way that, you know, you're this kid that has these interests, but you're not going to find other people that can really guide you through any of that or show you that it is a lifestyle until you sort of lock in with those older cats.
Yeah.
Who are like, you know, living it.
Yeah.
And then when you first meet them, you're like, oh, you can be a grown up and fucking do this.
Yeah.
So you had them.
Yeah. I had a great, you know, Murray, yeah, for instance, our bass player was really great.
How'd
in
he
respect.
Find you?
He had a girlfriend, Jennifer, and I had a girlfriend, Jennifer, and they were friends with each other, and they said,
so
hey,
he was
you
dating,
like each other.
So he's dating a younger girl.
She was a little bit younger than
because
him.
Because he's 7 years
and
older.
And I was dating an older girl at the time,
okay,
when I was 15.
Okay, so.
I always hung out with older people.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't you? At least you want to be understood, even if it's a little bit condescending.
Yeah.
Like, even if they're sort of like, oh, look at the little arty kid.
Exactly. I didn't mind. Like, I'm learning from you fuckers.
Yeah. And what were you learning outside of music? What was the art scene like there? Was there photographers, performance art? I mean, still.
There was all sorts of weird shit. Yeah. I learned that music was the only way that I could see to make a life out of it. Because the rest of it, like, I'm not gifted in any kind of visual art sense.
Right.
But I just think that's tough because you make a painting. That painting doesn't do shit. It just sits there.
Yeah.
One person buys it one time.
Yeah.
You know, if I do a song, I can play it every night. I can put it on a record. I can sell it. So it just seemed like an easier commodity to try and, you know,
sure,
negotiate.
So you knew that.
So I knew that, but I did like all the weirdos and the artists and the stray cats that lived around. I remember they used to follow me around. I would just walk around.
It's great,
you know,
man. It's great to know that there is an alternate reality to the mainstream idea.
Yeah.
You know, and that it's much more interesting.
I just went back and spoke to the kids at St. Mark's School, my alma mater. And I've done this before over the years. I had my 20th reunion. That was fucked up. But I've done it over the years where I'll go back and try and pick the 5 or 6 songs that are the least inappropriate for me to sing for these, you know, the middle school and the upper school. But I went back this time and I decided I'm going to give them a speech. I'm going to sing a couple of songs and then I'm going to give them a speech because since I left, the school's become way more sort of business oriented and it's driving kids specifically into, you know, hedge funds and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And which is fine. I get it. You know, you got to make money. But so I gave a speech about there is a possibility of a life in the arts. You probably have to give up the idea of being really wealthy, but you can make enough of a living to have a family and a house.
Right.
And what you're doing, and you have to ask yourself, is giving up the money, is the sacrifice of that worth getting to fucking make something beautiful and give it to the world? Because you're making the world a better place. What you do
true.
Is making the world a better place.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know if I ever really thought about that because it's hard to know. But because I always assume, like I've said before, that like I think music is sort of magic, and it sort of replenishes itself. It doesn't lose its magic. It really just doesn't.
Yeah.
Like once something is laid down, when once a song exists in the world, you can go back to it at different points in your life. And either get something new out of it or get exactly what you got out of it the first time, that it will connect with something fundamental to your soul or to your heart. And it will always be there. I mean, and if it wears out, you don't listen to it for a while.
Yeah.
And then eventually you're like, I want to hear that song. And you're like, holy fuck, it still works. Like that's an amazing thing to me. And then when you think about it as a gift, it definitely is. It definitely is something that makes the world a better place. And you can't deny that about art. I don't know why I'm just thinking about that now. Because if you, like, even when I think about artists that don't resonate or don't get as big as other artists or whatever, there is that moment in your life where you experience that and it does something to your brain that's going to shift you in the direction of freedom and a better place than the other way.
Yeah.
It's art versus an empty existence.
Exactly. And that was where I came out the other side with the suicide thing was this is what it's all about, filling up the world with beauty.
Yeah.
You know, and Rainn Wilson's become a friend over the years and he's a Baha'i guy.
Yeah.
And which actually kind of is cool. Like I'm not a religious guy.
But, yeah. They kind of mix it up.
Yeah. But one thing that he said that I really, really liked was the creation of art, the act of creation is prayer. Like that is the holiest thing you can do because, you know, you're acknowledging something bigger. Like, because the most cynical thing you can do is just sit on a couch and do nothing and just be a vessel filled up with, you know, whatever.
Or just work.
Or just work. Yeah, exactly.
Work for the empty payoff of, I don't think security and a sense of well-being is necessarily empty. And certainly there's a lot of people that struggle to even have that.
Yeah.
But to sort of, you know, not have any definition that nourishes your spirit, you know, in this process of working is a disaster. And I don't like the sort of like, well, I have an empty job so I can have enough money to retire with, and on weekends I go on the boat. I'm not begrudging that, and there's part of me that envies people that accept that as like an okay life, you know, and that, you know, what is, but it's not for everybody, the art thing.
I know.
It just isn't.
Yeah, some people weren't meant to do it, but...
And they're okay.
Yeah, but that's what I was saying to the kids. It's like, obviously, most of you guys are going to do the kind of stuff your parents do and make a lot of money, and that'll be great. But there are some kids in here that are maybe meant to do art or music or whatever.
And you're like, you know who you are.
Yeah, exactly. But they're scared shitless because it's fucking scary.
And their parents are like, a lot of times parents who don't want kids to do that, it's only out of fear of their future.
Yeah.
There's very few parents that are like, art sucks. Don't be a pussy. They exist. And I'm sure that they're, you know, your parents weren't like that though, were they?
No.
No, but they exist. But that's a different problem. The people I've talked to who are creative people, if their parents resisted, it was usually because they were afraid for their future.
Of course. And when I dropped out of college, my parents, you know, said, whatever little money we have, you don't get it because you did that. You gave up a $100,000 scholarship to a great college, and now you've got no fallback plan. No. And I was like, that's the whole point. I don't want a degree that I can fall back on because then I'll do it because it's way easier. And so for 10 years, I fucking ate ramen noodles. Did you go through the real squalor? Like
Well, my parents were relatively supportive, but once I started doing comedy, I was very stubborn about taking money unless I really was in trouble.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I lived on the Lower East Side, but I really tried to earn my own money, but I was not ever completely cut off.
Yeah.
So it was squalor of a different kind. It was squalor in the sense that I didn't know how I was going to make it, but I never really thought about it.
But that's a good thing, right? Because it made you have to fucking get out there and work.
Yeah, but
and
I
work
never,
and get
I,
better.
I never thought of doing anything. I never practically thought of doing anything else. After a certain point, either you're compelled and possessed by it.
Yeah.
But like, there was never really a functional plan B other than go back to school for something vague. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that was always the thing. Like, I could go back to school. Like, you barely were there the first time. You did okay, but what do you think's going to happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. So you drop out. What were you studying? What was this?
It was creative writing I was there for.
Yeah, but why would they cut you off if that was your... I mean, there was no big payoff to creative writing.
Well, a college degree would, at least
it still held a certain amount of esteem then.
I know, right?
Something.
Yeah, not anymore.
So you drop out what year?
After one semester.
One semester?
Yeah. I had a
great... Were you depressed again or
no? No. I had a great semester.
Yeah.
I had two girlfriends who were incredibly awesome that one of whom I'm still really great friends with. I was all my friends were seniors was the funny thing. Again, I was only hanging out with the older kids.
And you seem like kind of a girl's guy. Seem like a guy that girls are going like, come here, let me take care of you.
I guess I've never suffered in that regard.
Poor you and your ramen noodles and pussy. Well, I find that about you. I notice that about the old 97s even, and primarily I think you, is that, you somehow amass this following of sort of groovy, you know, alty chicks, and they've sort of stayed with you. I imagine at this point that you have like 45-year-old women that have been watching you since they were 23.
Fortunately, the fan base does sort of regenerate, you know, and the weirdest way that it does is those 45-year-old women that you mentioned.
They bring their kids.
Their 22-year-old daughter. Yeah. That's when it gets a little weird.
Yeah.
But it's sweet. It's all right. I had a manager friend of mine said once, the old 97's records are for the dudes. Your solo records are for the chicks.
Is that true? Isn't it?
Yeah, I guess.
Kind of? Rock and roll in general?
That's the whole point of rock and roll. That's why there's on the new record, there's a song called Let's Get Drunk and Get It On. And when I brought it around, a bunch of people were like, are you serious? You can't just say that. I'm like, are you fucking kidding? That's what every single song I've ever written basically said in so many words.
Right. Yeah. Fuck me.
I mean, that's the whole point of rock and roll.
But you know, you gotta be sweet. You know, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of your lyrics speak to a vulnerability that is not that aggressive. Maybe that's what they were concerned about.
Yeah, definitely.
What are you, some drunk monster?
Oh, but the song is really sweet. It's a total love song. It just happens to put it all, you know, up
on front. That. Yeah. Well, all right. So let's get back to this country idea. So you know, you leave college and you are a folk singer to some degree, or at least a solo pop song writer. I mean, what was the thing that brought you guys into deciding that was your mode? Because I mean, the old 97s, you know, it's a country band, really.
Yeah. Well, Murray was living in D.C. when I was going to Sarah Lawrence, and he would come up on weekends and we would play, and I'd go down to the city and play. CBGB's was open at the time, and I used to play at the Cantina.
The place next to it.
And so I'd do every, like, Friday night, I'd be on the bill at the Cantina and go back up to the thing. But I was really just jonesing because I was used to doing music. I was doing 4 gigs a week before I went off to college. And so to be doing just one little 30-minute set a week was freaking me out.
Yeah.
And Murray would come up and play. We'd hang out and play. And so he was like, dude, you got to drop out.
Yeah.
So he goes, come on, drop out. We'll go back to Dallas. We'll start a band together. So went back to Dallas, started a band called Sleepy Heroes,
yeah,
which was really fun. But it was, you know, I've never been a great marketer. Like the word old, for instance, is apparently anathema to marketing.
Right.
So, you know, we started this band. It was a 3-piece. I played a 12-string Rickenbacker. Murray played bass, which wound up being sort of the only lead instrument. It wasn't going to happen. I remember there was a band around that time called Material Issue that came out.
I love them.
They were great,
Kim and the Waitress. I loved them.
So good.
That guy, I think, killed himself.
He did kill himself. But they were a 3-piece with, I think he played a bunch of 12-string. And so it was possible that format could have worked at that time for a minute, but we weren't executing it.
The world wasn't ready for that in general. I mean, I don't think it really worked for them. I mean, it was pretty limited still.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So that band broke up the day that the box of records came back from the manufacturer, or CDs, and for whatever reason, our drummer, whatever.
Here they are.
Problems. Yeah, here.
What do we do with them?
Again, just self, you know, defeating. So we broke up, and then I went through a series of bands. Oh God, it got complicated. Like Murray and I had a falling out briefly where we had entered a battle of the bands at the Hard Rock Cafe. We won the first round and we were going to go to the finals. In between the first round and the finals, Murray and I had a fight and I was upset because I'm going to get in so much trouble for saying this. Mark.
By who?
By Murray. Because because his mic technique was bumming me out. Like he wouldn't sing into the microphone enough, and then he couldn't hear himself enough, and then his harmonies would be off key. And I sort of tried to do an intervention to get him to. Oh, he's gonna be so mad.
What do you mean? How long ago that was? Like,
literally over. It was
20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Still,
he's not gonna get mad. He's not allowed to get mad. You guys have got to be beyond that.
I love you, Murray. But but it was stupid. It was just a dumb fight, you know. And so he quit the band, and then I brought in like a fill-in bass player to do the finals because there's like $5,000 worth of gear if you won, which we did. And Murray came and sat in the balcony and got drunk and watched us and was all mad. And so there's a couple of crazy years between Sleepy Heroes and the old 97s where I was trying different bands. And I had this one band called Buzz that was just a piece of shit. And I had a band called Rhett's Exploding. Like, why is that a good band? Who thinks that's a good band name?
I don't know.
Terrible.
You did, clearly.
Yeah. I think Murray thought of that band name, though. But so these bands were, like I said before, sludgy mid-tempo rock.
Yeah.
And they were kind of trying to be what Nirvana ended up being, which is this distorted guitar with real pop hooky things happening. And there was one night, Murray and I were roommates in the shithole apartment, Marquita Courts in Dallas. It was the night Nirvana did SNL.
Yeah.
And we watched that. And I remember we looked at each other and went, we got to fucking stop. We're never going to be as good as them.
Yeah.
And they're doing it. This is already happening. And we're trying to do something that's not even coming naturally to us. And so we took like 6 months off and we didn't do shit. And we were listening kind of obsessively to Hank Williams. And
just to feel better.
Exactly. Just because it was so pure.
Yeah.
You know, those songs, there's just they crystallize what I love about music.
Yeah.
The hooks and the sentiment and the kind of honest, raw emotion. And
yeah.
And the simplicity of it. So So we came together one day and we said, you know what, let's do this. And originally we said, no drummer. Let's just do something that's coffee shop based where we can play songs like the kind we really like. It doesn't stand a chance of, because those, the rock bands we were doing, the whole point was to try and get fucking signed, because this was a different era.
So did the A&R guys seek you out after Mythologies or no?
They would come around every once in a while, but they'd come and go, how can you do a band with no lead guitar?
Yeah,
you know, about Sleepy Heroes.
Where's the band? Yeah.
And then when we would, it just never worked. It never clicked. And you know why? Because it was fucking disingenuous.
Right.
Because we were calculating what the world wanted and then trying to give that to them.
Yeah.
And it was bullshit because people smell that.
Yeah.
So when we did Old 97s, the whole idea was, let's do a band that has no fucking chance of ever being popular or getting signed. It'll make us happy. And of course, ironically, because it was what we were, you know, sort of
let go of that
to
shit.
Do. Yeah. Yeah. And people started liking it.
Yeah. And a lot of people like it. You built a pretty good audience. You know, they sustain you, don't they?
They
still come around and it's the kind of music that doesn't really date itself.
Well, that was calculated. We were like, if we do this, it's just real. And we can do this for fucking ever. And, you know, look at Willie Nelson. And
sure.
Really, honestly, that's only ever been my goal, to be the next Willie Nelson or the next Christofferson, maybe, you know?
Right, but you don't seem to be living that life. I mean, you seem like you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah. I mean, Willie's all right. Willie still gets out.
No, but I mean, like, you know, it's a notoriously hard life. I mean, Chris, they all kind of beat themselves up at one time.
Yeah, but I think that maybe was more a product of that time. Like, back then, everybody was doing tons of coke.
Right.
And everybody
drank.
Although that was a really early on a decision that I made. I saw the people doing blow, and in my early 20s, I tried it some because I was working at a restaurant here and there between.
That's where you try blow at a restaurant.
Well, of
fucking
course.
Crazy chefs.
Yeah.
The guy who hangs around that has it.
There's always somebody that had it. And then, but I just realized, I would look at the guy that had it, and I'd be like, do I want to be that guy when I'm 40? Yeah. Fuck no, man.
Yeah.
So that was an early decision in the band. I was like, nobody do blow. You can smoke however much weed you want. You can drink. Just.
And
no smack, no blow.
Good. So no one got strung out?
Nobody, thank God. Not in the old 97s.
And that's why people bring their daughters to see you.
Well, 20 years later.
Yeah.
Well, it's so funny. You're saying that so it sustains me. It not only does it sustain me, but like this record we just put out is the biggest record we've ever put out. It's crazy. You know, we had our highest chart position. We're selling out venues that we'd never sold out before.
20 years in.
It only took 20 fucking years.
That's all right.
Yeah.
You still look good.
Thanks.
Just hurt your knee. You'll get over the knee. But because the record, it rocks. It feels good. And the first song is a nice, long song.
It's a meditation on a life in rock and roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that guitar, is that you up front on that thing?
The acoustic is me.
Oh, who's on that electric?
That's Ken. Ken's the...
That's a filthy sounding guitar. I like it.
Yeah, he's like the defining sound of our band. I mean, as much as Murray's ooze and my whatever.
Yeah.
Ken's weird surf, his caveman guitars.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and it seems real autobiographical. It seems like, you know, I think what's happening is that, you know, there's a wisdom to it now.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys, you know, you still seem to get along. You still put out good music. You can do your solo albums and people love those. But then when you guys all come together, you're pros and you can speak from a place of fucking earned wisdom.
And it took 20 years for me to, because I know just from my interactions with you and what I've heard of your stuff that you battle with that like self-worth, like, do I belong here? Am I good enough? That anxiety.
Right.
I always suffered from that. Like, you know, like I'd meet somebody famous and I'd be like, oh God, they don't want to talk to me. Why would they want to fucking talk to me?
Yeah, I'm not in their league. And
I saw the Ray Romano episode of the That's so fucking funny. But I've always kind of felt like that. Oh, thanks for inviting me. You know, You know, and stop it, Ray. You sound like an idiot.
Yeah.
But
you don't, like, the weird thing about that disposition is what is going to change that? What kind of input are you going to get? They're not, if people really love you.
Yeah.
They're going to be feeling the same thing. Like, I'm just going to be cool. It's Rhett Miller, and you know, I'm not going to ooze. You know, but like a lot of people are like, you're fucking great, and you never believe them when they say that. Especially if Willie Nelson said, "I love your stuff." You're like, "Thanks for being nice." So, you know, it's all an internal dialogue.
But it took this long, and now I don't really have that. I mean, it's still something
you don't
I'll
have
always,
the fear.
I'll always battle with it, but I don't have that. Like, I don't belong here. I suck. I'm not good enough. And it took me fucking forever to get over that.
And that's this record.
Yeah, that's this record.
Well, there you go.
Boom.
You don't give a fuck anymore.
Yeah.
Finally.
Finally.
Congratulations. So when you worked with John Bryan, now, because like I'm still sort of fascinated with the idea, like, because like when you look at I guess a good comparison would be the breakup of Uncle Tupelo.
Yeah.
In a sense that, you know, what happened between Jay and Jeff, you know, Jeff had a sort of loftier pop aspirations, and Jay was, you know, a country rock guy.
Yeah.
And they couldn't survive it. So as a band, so what seems that you're able to do is you have, you know, the old 97s, which does your songs, and you guys do have, you know, pop elements off, obviously, but you're grounded and rooted in that sound, the traditional sound, and you can go do your pop records, and there's no big tension there.
It first, it was weird. We had just done Satellite Rides, which was our last record for Elektra, and it was 99, 2000, and the whole business was changing. It was when, you know, it kind of imploded. Elektra Records was about to fold. Elektra picked up the option for me to do a solo record, but not for the next 97's record.
And right.
That fact alone was weird, created a lot of tension. And then I went off and did a record that had do you remember back then the record budgets were, that was like a $350,000 record. Who fucking needs $350,000 to make a record? I mean, John Bryan and I spent every penny of it. we locked out the studio, NRG Studios, for like 4 months.
Uh-huh.
We brought in Jim Keltner and Josh Fries and like the greatest musicians in the world. And we would spend whole days trying to find a guitar tone for like one solo.
Did you like that?
I had never known anything like that before. I'd only made records with the 97s, which tended to be much quicker, more live kind of affairs. It was really fun. I mean, watching John Bryan work and, you know, getting paid to watch him work, it's awesome. And it was a great experience.
I've never been in a studio like
Trapper Chev and the Shades. Yeah. I'm friends with those guys.
Yeah, yeah. They asked me to play on a song, and what's his name was producing it. You know, the guy used
Brandon Minson, who's great.
He's great. But I'd never experienced any of that. You know, the type of kind of like finessing that you can do down to a note you want. I was like, holy fuck, this is a real job. Yeah. I've been here all day. You know, I thought I knocked this solo out, you know, an hour ago. I thought I nailed that rhythm.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, I mean, it's a whole other world, that shit. It ain't just playing with your friends.
No, but now, there was a time back when that record got made, we had a guy on staff whose job was to go home every night and comp things.
Yeah.
Which, you know, which is to compile different performances into the perfect Frankenstein monster performance.
Yeah.
Which is now so par for the course and accepted that I feel like it's kind of sucked a lot of the fun and humanity out of music because everything is so perfectly comped. Back then, you had to have like a full-time guy to do that. Now people can just comp so quickly.
Right.
You know, it's a lot. The technology has made it so much easier, which is good and bad.
Well, what'd you take away from that, you know, in terms of your music, of working with a guy who is sort of a genius like John Bryan? I mean, in that experience, how did that affect the future of what you do?
Well, I learned to play diminished chords, for one thing.
Basic guitar stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a really inspiring guy because it's always about just following your instinct. Like for him, his instincts involve seeing, I think, really seeing the architecture of the music as it's unfolding in front of like the next 5 seconds and 5 minutes are all unfolded in his mind. And he knows where he's going and what he's doing. But it's really about trusting your instincts and not settling for, well, that was good enough, I guess.
Right.
You know, and John would never do, he would never be like, that's good enough,
right,
I guess.
Right, that's the same with what's his name?
Brendan Benson, yeah.
Same thing. Like, they're possessed.
Yeah, and they both can pull it off.
And they have a vision, obviously. I mean, they that's right. It's trusting your instincts, which is not something that you and I do naturally.
No, but it's ironic because you and I both do jobs where you have to do that. You have to make immediate decisions.
Right, but you fake it a lot. And a lot of those things are reactive, so you're not really thinking it.
That's true. I've heard you say stuff where you'll fall, like, I'll go to this routine. If so-and-so's happening. I remember David Cross opened for me a million years ago at the Fez, the Underground Cafe in New York.
Yeah,
such
a
great room. Yeah, it was my old favorite room. And it was just a goof. Like, I was like, hey, do you want to come do a set opening? Yeah. And he's like, yeah, fine. Fuck it. I just got off this college tour. Yeah. And so he tried out a bunch of material that was like, not even material.
Yeah.
Like, he just walked up there and was like,
Rambo.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it was an audience that didn't really understand who he was, I don't think.
Yeah.
And he was kind of bombing.
Yeah.
And I saw it.
He knows how to bomb.
And I saw it in his face where he was like, fuck you people. And he went into like his most killer A routine.
And
he slayed. And he walked off stage to just people going ape shit. Yeah. But I could see it in his face like, fuck this. I'm going to do the
There's that moment where like, all right, bring it. Yeah, yeah. Well, I talked to like those guys, like the guys in Blues Traveler, which was interesting because they come out of that whole jam band world.
Yeah.
And it was like they knew, like the one thing that I got out of that was that like don't shoot your load too early.
Yeah. Save the big song to the end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or even the build of a song.
Yeah.
Or even like, you know, like even if you're going to play some lead, like, you know, make sure you save the big, you know, the big stuff for the end.
That's funny. I wrote a song. The one co-write on the new record is with this guy in Nashville, this funny old songwriter named John McElroy that I got put together randomly with. And I saw him in Nashville. We played the other night and we'd written the song together and he's really proud, it turns out, of the song. And he plays it for people. He's like, if Dylan came over to my house, this is the song I'd play him. And we had fun writing. Yeah. We got fucking wasted at 10 in the morning and his house full of ferrets and weird animals. But he, when I walked into his house, he said, I've been looking you up on YouTube and I think your audience would appreciate it if you walk up to the mic and said, fuck. And so he had this idea for a chorus and the chorus was, who'd I gotta blow to get in this fucking show? It's dark in there, I know, and I got nowhere else to go. And so together we came up with this story about, you know, I married Caroline. It's this whole story about this guy who just fucks up his world, up, makes mistake after mistake. And so in the first verse of the version that we recorded, he said, I married Caroline back in May of 99. It was fucked up at the time, but I figured we'd keep trying. And so he goes, you know, the one thing I wish we had changed is I wish we had, because in the second verse, it's, wake up from this motherfucking dream. So there's a big motherfucking that happens.
Yeah.
And then it goes into the chorus with who'd I gotta blow.
Yeah.
So he's like, the one thing I wish we had done is saved the fuck till when the motherfucking happens. Because it's like, you shoot your wad too early with the fuck in the first verse.
Yeah.
But I sort of disagree because I'm thinking like, fuck it. This is the song where it's I get to say song. Fuck. I'm going to say fuck every chance I get.
Right. Well, that's interesting though. That's the songwriter instinct. It's an entertainer's instinct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you want to play a song?
I would love to. I guess I'll play Nashville since we talked about it.
Okay.
Well, I married Caroline back in May of 99. Was fucked up at the time, but I figured we'd keep trying. Her brother and her dad, they were spitting mad when I packed up what I had and took off running. It was bad, it was mean, I didn't care. And it's gotten me nowhere, so I'm trying to be a better man. I turn left, turns into right. Turn sunshine into night. Got my ass kicked every fight. No, I couldn't get it right. I built castles out of sand. I couldn't understand why everything I planned ran like whiskey off my hands, and my hands were never clean. Things I wished I'd never seen. I'd do anything to wake up from this motherfucking dream. Food I got to blow to get in this fucking show. It's dark in there, I know, and I got nowhere else to go. Well, I need a place to hide, so I'll put away my pride and come inside, cause I'm tired of running. It's floating out in space, and I look up there and I can't find my face, and I'm seeing my reflection backstage, writing down the same old words on the same old page. Who'd I got to blow to get in this fucking show? It's dark in there, I know, and I got nowhere else to go. I need a place to hide, so I'll put away my pride and come inside, cause I'm tired of running. Yeah, I said, who'd I got to blow to get in this fucking show? It's dark in there, I know, and I got nowhere else to go. I need a place to hide, so I'll put away my pride and come inside, cause I'm tired of running. And come inside, cause I'm tired of running. And come inside, cause I'm tired of running.
Yeah. Woo. God damn. That guitar sounds so full.
Nice. Gibson J200.
It's unbelievable. I play this little J45, but that thing's just full. That's great. Well, thanks, man. It was great talking to you.
It was so great being... You know, you've always been so nice and kind to me when we've run into each other, and I'm honored. And you know what? I'm really proud of all your kick-ass success.
Way oh, thank you. You too, man. I'm glad the fear is gone.
Woo!
Yeah. See, that was a fun chat, wasn't it?
That guy's a good guy. Good song. Go to WTF.com for all your WTF needs. We got the merch in there. That's a Stratocaster. That's that Strat sound, man. Am I right? Happy Thanksgiving, and I like this sound a little better. Boomer lives!